This is lecture number 3 by Robert Vinoy on the major prophets. Robert Vinoy is dealing with the prophet Isaiah. Lecture number 3. There are 3 interpretive eschatological positions, and by eschatological we mean the end times. And these positions are the premillennial, the amillennial, and the postmillennial positions. Let me give you an idea of how the post-mills work with the passage, and I'll be using the shortened form of post-mill for post-millennial, a-mill for amillennial, and pre-mill for premillennial. So let's take a look at a post-mill position, and in doing that, I'll be using J.A. Alexander, famous commentator. I might mention his commentary on Isaiah is very useful. He cites a lot of other sources, and he goes into the original text. There's a lot of helpful material there. But he does his interpretation from a post-mill perspective when you come to the sections of Isaiah that have an eschatological aspect to them. We'll look at number 2 on your citations page. I've just lifted some excerpts on various verses from Alexander. Note the first paragraph, and I'm quoting Alexander here. In the first part, the prophet foretells the future exaltation of the church and the accession of the Gentiles in chapters 2-4. So you see, Alexander sees the whole prophecy as the future exaltation of the church. Notice his wording that, quote, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the chief of the mountain raised above the hills. He says that's Jerusalem. That is symbolic of the church, he says. What about the phrase in Isaiah that says, all nations will flow into it? That, he says, is the Gentiles coming into the church. He goes on to say, and I'm quoting here, after the title similar to that in chapter 1, verse 1 of Isaiah, the prophecies of the church at some distant period will be exalted and conspicuous, and the nations resorting to it for instruction and true religion will come to the church. End quote. As a consequence of which, he sees war cease and universal peace prevail. That's verses 2-4. So you see, as the gospel goes forth and people from all nations come to Christ, the ultimate results will be the cessation of war and establishment of universal peace. Regarding Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2, Alexander says, and again I'm quoting him here, the prophecy begins with an abrupt prediction of the exaltation of the church, the confluence of nations to it, and the general classification of the consequence are in verses 2-4. Instead of saying, in modern phraseology, that the church is a society that shall become conspicuous and attract all nations, he represents it by the mountain upon which the temple stood as having been raised and fixed above other mountains, so it could be visible in all directions. End quote. And again, that's Alexander's explanation of what it means that the mountain of the Lord will be raised. And then he goes on to say, and I'm quoting him again here, it's symbolic language that fits the church. End quote. And that's on page 97. I might mention that first sentence on page 95 and the second paragraph on page 96 is his commentary in the list of quotations that I have. I continue with Alexander. This confluence of the nations is described more fully and its motives stated in their own words, namely, a desire to be instructed in the true religion of which Jerusalem, or Zion, under the old dispensation, was the sole depositor. That's on page 98. And then he goes on, for out of Zion shall go forth the law, is true religion, as rule of duty, and the word of Jehovah, the true religion is revealed from Jerusalem, which, according to Alexander, is the church. Verse 4 is really the crux of the passage. That's where we read, swords shall be beaten into plowshares, neither should they learn war any more. And here Alexander says, and I'm quoting him again, here one who would appear in the preceding verses as lawgiver and teacher of the nations is now represented as arbiter or umpire, ending their disputes by specific intervention as the necessary consequence of which war ceases. The very knowledge of the art is lost and its implements applied to other uses. This prediction was not fulfilled in the general peace under Emperor Augustus, which was only temporary, nor is it fulfilled now at present. The event is suspended upon the previous condition, namely the confluence of the nations to the Church, which has not taken place. This is a strong inducement to diffuse the gospel, which in the meantime is peaceful and in the spirit tending to that in the actual effect, wherever, and notice, wherever, so far as it exerts its influence without obstruction, war cease. And when it says, He shall judge and arbitrate between nations and decide for many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, nations shall not lift up sword against nations, neither shall they learn war any more. See, what he is saying is that is to happen through the spread of the gospel. We just haven't gotten far enough down the road yet for the gospel to have this kind of effect. Of course, you realize he was writing a century ago, but we're not a whole lot closer now as we were then to seeing the results of the cessation of war. But that's the post-mill interpretation. It's the motivation to spread the gospel because through the spread of the gospel, these conditions, that is lack of war, will come as a result of regeneration in the hearts of people. That's a representation of Alexander, and it's also a representation of the post-mill interpretation of these verses in Isaiah. Now, another illustration of that position is Daleitz of the famous Kyle and Daleitz commentaries. Page 5 of your citations. Of verse 3 in Isaiah, Daleitz says this on page 116 of his work, and I'm quoting here, "It was fulfilled, as Theodoret observes, in the fact that the word of the gospel rising from Jerusalem, as from a fountain, flowed through the whole of the known world. But these fulfillments were only preludes to a conclusion which is still to be looked for in the future of what is promised in the following verses, which is still unfulfilled." And that's the end of the quote from Daleitz. Then in verse 4, which is on page 116 and 117, Daleitz continues, "And he will judge between the nations and deliver justice to many people as they look forward to converting their swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not pick up sword against nation, neither do they exercise themselves in war any more." And we continue again with Daleitz, who says, "With such power is this peace-sustaining word of God, that is the gospel. There is no more need in weapons of iron. They are turned into the weapons of peaceful employment. There's no more need for military practice, for there's no use in exercising oneself in what cannot be applied as useful. There is peace, not an armed peace, but a full, true, God-given, and blessed peace. It is in war that the power of the beast," referring to Revelation, "culminates in the history of the world. The beast will then be destroyed. The true humanity will send his chosen up and gain the mastery. The world will keep the Sabbath," end quote. Notice now his next statement, and again going to Daleitz, "May we not indulge the hope on the ground of such prophetic words as these, that the history of the world will not terminate without having kept the Sabbath? Shall we correct Isaiah, according to the commentator Quenset, lest we should become healist, that is premillennialists, people who see a future millennial period?" And he asked that as a question. "The humanitarian ideas of Christendom," he continues, as he quotes the thoughtful Jewish scholar, whom he mentions later, "has its roots in the Pentateuch and more in Deuteronomy. But the prophets, particularly in Isaiah, reach a height that will not be obtained and fully realized by the modern world for centuries to come." That's what the Jewish fellow scholar that Daleitz mentions says. And then Daleitz says, "Yet they," the prophetic words, "will be realized. What the prophetic words appropriated by Isaiah here affirms is the moral posture, the goal of sacred history that predicted the counsel of God." And there I end his quotes. So, a postmillennial view sees this prophecy as telling us that through the church and the spread of the gospel to the ends of the earth, eventually conditions will be created in which war ceases. All right, that's a postmillennial understanding of this passage. Let's go back to an amillennial understanding. I have touched on that in discussing E.J. Young's view of the last days, the phrase the last days, and the way in which he sees this prophecy fitting into, quote, the last days, end quote. Now look at page 8, the citation we haven't looked at right in the middle of the page, and this comes from pages 101 and 102 of Young's commentary in Isaiah, where it says, and I'm quoting here, "By means of this picture, Isaiah wishes to teach the truth that the worship of the Lord is expressed by metonymy, as, quote, the mountain of the house of the Lord," end quote. So you see, we're in figurative language here, according to Young. I continue. "The worship of the Lord, then, expressed by metonymy as the mountain of the house of the Lord, will triumph over all other religions and forms of worship. The place in which the superiority of the worship of the Lord is revealed is that of the recognition outside of Israel. In Isaiah's day, this worship was comparatively obscure and was practically confined to Israel. The nations regarded the Lord as the God merely of Israel, a local deity like Chemosh of the Moabites. The latter days, however, inasmuch as Zion would be exalted, this religion of Israel would be known throughout the world. In the light of the New Testament, we may say that the reference of this prophecy is to the church which Jesus Christ founded, beginning in Jerusalem. The disciples went throughout the world proclaiming the true salvation. This church, as the pillar and ground of the truth, is to be preached for every creature." End quote. And so at that point, you have an agreement between the postmillennialist and the amillennialist as to the role of the church and the spread of the gospel. Now, that's E.J. Young. Okay, follow along there. This comes from page 102, and 12 is a footnote. And I'm quoting here. "By a number of modern writers, this passage is said to be fulfilled during the millennium to follow the return of Christ." In reply, and listen to the reply to that E.J. Young gives about the millennium, and he says, and I'm quoting here, "We must note this prophecy is attributed to the latter days, which are the messianic days. Because it's the latter days, it can't be the millennium. Furthermore, the blessings taken are spiritual. Men will seek the Lord that they may walk in his ways. But men take the Lord only when the Lord draws them to do so. It is the work of the Holy Spirit in connection of the preaching of the gospel that does this." And I end the quote from E.J. Young here. Then notice the next paragraph, which comes from page 103 of Young, and I'm quoting, "No longer does merely one nation know the Lord, but all nations know him. When Isaiah says many people, he does not mean all people, but simply a great multitude. Those who formerly were but strangers and foreigners are now fellow citizens with the saints. During the Old Testament dispensation, the glory of the gospel was hid with the nation. In the latter days, however, the church stands out, and to it men of all nations will come. The people are now scattered nations returning to the Lord, and they will all become one. All nations will flow into Zion. No nation will be excluded. Out of all these nations, there will be many people. Zion is the center of truth. If a man wishes to hear the truth, he must go to the place where the truth is found, namely the church of the living God, where the truth of God flows from." End of quote from E.J. Young. Then we have the next paragraph. This goes back to the heart of the Amill position. And again, continuing with E.J. Young. He says, and I'm quoting here, "There are two prevalent types of answers to the interpretation given in this commentary. On the one hand, there are those who say that it is possible that war may cease entirely in this time, in the age before the return of Christ from heaven." That would be the post-mill position. On the other hand, there are those known as dispensationalists who maintain that the prophecy is not fulfilled in the present age, but will be fulfilled in the millennium, which follows the return of Christ. End quote. Now, notice his comment about that view, that is, the dispensational view, and this prophecy being fulfilled in the millennium. To wit, he says, and I quote him again, "This latter type of interpretation does violence of a serious kind, to what we might ask, to the general structure of biblical eschatology." End quote. In other words, his argument here is more in the structure of the position that the system does violence, and that's his answer. And we may answer both these positions as follows. So now, here's what he sets over against either a post-mill interpretation or pre-mill interpretation. He says, we may enter both these positions as follows. Insofar as men learn of the Lord and are taught of him, they will seek to apply in their lives the principles of his government. End quote. So that's the qualification, you see. And that is, in the phrase, insofar as men learn of the Lord and seek to apply the principles of his government. Consequently, even at the present day, and here's his qualification, insofar as men believe the gospel and seek to practice it in their lives, this prophecy finds fulfillment. At the same time, it must be remembered that sin is still present, and it will not be until the complete removal of sin in the second advent of the Lord that this prophecy, that is, war ceasing, will be realized in its completeness. Whereas, therefore, the latter days continue until the second coming of the Lord, the blessed conditions which are introduced by these last days will abide forever. This prophecy will only be understood in the general light of the general structure of eschatology. And that's the end of the quotes from Young. Well, you see, he's right back to that thing which is in the last paragraph of that same page, which is really a footnote to that paragraph in the text. And that is when he says that it is absolutely fulfilled in principle, but only in principle. It is fulfilled insofar as men commit themselves to the Lord and obedience to the Lord that these conditions of peace are realized. In completeness, he says, it's not within the latter days. He's pushing it to the eternal age. Now, what is the degree of spiritualization of what is being understood by, quote, beating swords into plowshares, end quote? You see, basically what Young is saying is that in principle it's fulfilled as long as people are nice to each other, or we should say as long as people who have the gospel are nice to each other. But are you going to say that doesn't really mean that wars are going to cease, but it's peace in the heart of humans? Young doesn't quite go that far. There are some on-mill interpreters, by the way, who do. Young gets around that problem by the qualification that we have mentioned. We will see this peace to the extent that people submit themselves to the will of the Lord. But because sin is still present, it's never going to be perfectly fulfilled. So that the complete fulfillment has to go beyond the last days into the eternal state. As he says, there are difficulties with this, to say the least. All we can do is be faithful to the structure of eschatology. So it's his system that is forcing him in this direction. Now, I have a real problem with this view. I don't think it does justice to the language of the text. When it says in verse 4, quote, he will judge between the nations and settle the disputes of many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation. There is no qualification there. That's not talking about something partially fulfilled or fulfilled in principle, but later to be completely fulfilled. He is describing what is going to happen when people receive the law of the Lord as it goes forth from Zion, and he judges the nations and rules them. This seems to be concrete, not spiritual. Now, let's look at Calvin's commentary on page 3 and 4. I'm not going to read all that we have from Calvin, but look at the second paragraph. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. Calvin also believes it's talking about the church, just as Young does, but Calvin says, He, Isaiah, next mentions the beneficial result which will follow when Christ shall have brought the Gentiles and nations under his dominion. Nothing is more desirable than peace, but while all imagine that they desire it, they disturb it by the madness of their lusts. For pride and covetousness and ambition lead men to rise up in cruelty against one another. Since, therefore, men are naturally led away by their evil passions to serve society, Isaiah here promises correction of this evil, and that is the gospel of reconciliation. Look at 2 Corinthians 5:18, which removes the enmity between us and God. So it brings men into peace and harmony with each other as well. The meaning amounts to this, that Christ's people will be meek, and laying aside fierceness, will be devoted to the pursuit of peace. And that's Calvin. Look at the last paragraph on that page, and continuing again with a sentence from Calvin. Besides, Isaiah promises that when the gospel shall be published, it will be an excellent remedy for putting an end of quarreling. End quote. You could wish it were so. You don't have to look to too many churches to find that it's not functioning well in the churches, let alone society. Of course, the way these people would respond to that would be, well, people are not really submitting to the Lord and following his will, or we wouldn't have all this quarreling. That may be true, but is that what this prophecy is talking about? Let's continue with Calvin when he says, it will be an excellent remedy for putting an end to quarrels, and not only so, but that when resentments have been laid aside, men will be disposed to assist one another. For he does not merely say, that is Isaiah, say, swords will be broken into pieces. He says they will be turned into mattocks, or pruning hooks, by which he shows there will be so great a change that instead of annoying one another, committing various injustice acts as they formerly had done, they will cultivate peace and friendship and will employ their exertions for the common benefit of all. That's Calvin up to that point. But we have more from Calvin, and let's go down to the next paragraph. And again, I'm quoting from Calvin. Where it says, neither shall they practice war any more, the Hebrew word used there for learn, lamad, signifies either to be accustomed to or to learn. But the meaning of the prophet is plain enough. They will not train themselves in destructive arts and will not strive with each other in acts of cruelty and injustice as they were formerly accustomed to do. Hence we affirm that they have made, notice this sentence, little proficiency in the gospel whose hearts have not been formed to meekness and among whom there does not reign the brotherly love which leads men to perform kind offices to each other. End quote. And basically what he is saying is that if we have strife among Christians is because we haven't done our job in absorbing the gospel as we should, and if we have strife with those outside the church, we haven't done our job of proclaiming the gospel so that they too would believe, be regenerated, and come into the church. Now, the next paragraph, and it's interesting that Calvin brings this up because from what he said so far, it would seem that if you're a Christian and you would be a follower of the Lord, you'd have to be a pacifist. Well, Calvin's aware of that conclusion. So notice the next paragraph where he says the following. Some mad men torture this passage to promote anarchy, as if it took away from the church entirely the right to use the sword, and bring it, that is this passage from Isaiah, forward to condemn with great disparity every kind of war. For example, if a prince defends a people entrusted to him to protect them against injustice, for these people it is unlawful for Christians to use the sword in any way. But it is easy to reply to this pacifistic notion, for the prophet speaks metaphorically about the kingdom of Christ. And those are Calvin's words. So in other words, it's figurative language, not to be taken literally. Notice what Calvin says again about Isaiah, and he says he speaks metaphorically about the kingdom of Christ, which leads men through mutual kindness to become reconciled to one another. What he is saying is what is being talked about here is not actual warfare, what we normally think of when we talk about war. It's a matter of relationships between believers. The scriptures frequently employ a metaphor in which the thing signified is the matter that is assigned, as in that passage where he says, "He who has no sword, let him buy one," which was said by Jesus on the night of his betrayal. Christ certainly did not intend to induce his followers to fight, but intimated the time of war was at hand. Well, let's look at the last paragraph, and again, we quote, "It may be objected that in a state of harmony and peace, the sword will no longer be needed. I reply that peace exists," and here he sounds just like Young, and in fact, Young probably drew it from Calvin, where he says, "I reply that peace exists among us just as far as the kingly power of Christ is acknowledged, and that these two things have a mutual relation. Would that Christ reigned entirely in us, but he doesn't, so we still have these problems, i.e. war among believers and non-believers alike." And that is the end of our quotes from Calvin. Well, I must give one more line from Calvin, and that's at the end, the fourth line up in the last paragraph. Notice what Calvin says. "The fulfillment of this prophecy, Isaiah, that we've been speaking of, to its full extent must not be looked for on earth." And he pushes it again. "It is enough that we experience the beginning. Being reconciled to God through Christ is in mutual friendship bringing harmony." And there I really am ending the words of Calvin. Well, notice in all this the problem of the latter days for the amillennialist. He takes the latter days as this time between the Advents. He has a very difficult time seeing how precisely the words of this Isaiah prophecy are fulfilled presently. So they have to result to this principle or to some type of qualified fulfillment. Let me give you one other amillennialist. I do this more as an illustration of a somewhat different approach. And this person is Theodore Leitch, and that's on page 6. Leitch is a Lutheran, a Missouri Synod Lutheran, but also an amillennialist. His commentary is on the Minor Prophets, and this paragraph on page 6 from Leitch is taken from his comments on the Micah parallel. And that passage is in Micah chapter 4, where it says, "Swords shall be beaten to plowshares." Now, it's from Micah, but we're dealing with the same issue. And here's what Leitch says. Micah himself speaks not of political peace among the nations of the world. He speaks here very definitely of Christ's kingdom of grace established by the word of God, proceeding from Zion and Jerusalem and gathering people throughout the world into one Christian church. End quote. Then notice in the next sentence, which is an interesting one to me, I continue with Leitch. "The Christian from Alabama and the Christian from Ohio, one wearing the southern gray and the other the northern blue, were fighting against each other in bloody battle. Yet both were brethren in Christ, both members of his kingdom of peace, both wanting faith in their common Savior, and both enjoying the peace procured for them by the Prince of Peace and praying for the spiritual welfare of each other." End quote. So Leitch would take the Civil War, the war between the states, where the North and the South were killing each other, and there were believers doing this, but at the same time, they realized their oneness in Christ and the peace of Christ that he gave in their hearts, and they were praying for one another, even though they were shooting at one another. You see, Young backs off of that complete spiritualization in the present state, pushing the complete spiritualization into the eternal state, as does Calvin, but Leitch does not. Now, it seems to me we have looked at the postmillennial and the amillennial views, and it seems to me that the premillennial view avoids the problems of both of these positions. The postmill have a problem with other scriptures that say things get worse and worse, and you still have the problem of whether the spread of the gospel is actually going to produce this kind of situation. The Amiel position is locked into this in-between Advent's position. That is, all this occurs between the first and second Advent. There's no millennium. And they must qualify the fulfillment in this time and see at least in some sense a figurative fulfillment at present. Now, the premill view seems to me to have the least problems. It can take Jerusalem literally, which seems to be required particularly in the Micah context of the same prophecy. Jerusalem is to be destroyed and plowed like a field, but in the future days it's going to be exalted, and the word of the Lord is going to go forth from Jerusalem, and the Lord himself is going to judge the nations. And people are going to beat their swords into plowshares, and there will be war no more. So it seems to me that the prophecy can be best understood to lead you to a premill conclusion as far as times of fulfillment. The two other views, the amill and the postmill, have serious problems with this, as I've mentioned before. But let me raise another question. This still does not totally resolve the issue of literal interpretation versus figurative interpretation for the meaning of verse 2. We discussed last quarter this whole issue of literal versus figurative, and I tried to discuss that somewhat abstractly then. I tried to say at that point that it's a very difficult problem to distinguish between the two at times. I don't know of any simple rule of thumb to do so. To say I always take something literally is not adequate. Sometimes things are obviously intended to be figurative. The question is, when is something intended to be taken figuratively and when is something intended to be taken literally? That is something you have to wrestle with. It is something that is involved in the process of interpretation, and especially in interpretation of prophetic material. When you read in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2, quote, "In the last days the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it," end quote. What is this really talking about? At what degree of literal versus figurative do you bring to that text? You see, the Amills would take an extremely figurative interpretation and say that this is simply speaking of the prominence of the church. It's using the Old Testament Zion, or Jerusalem, to represent the church. So, the phrase, "the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains, it will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it," they say this is talking about the church. Others say, no, it's not talking about the church. We ought to understand it literally. It's talking about Jerusalem, particularly because of the context in Micah. But if you take it literally as referring to Jerusalem, then what about some of that language of the last phrase, where it says, "it," meaning Jerusalem, or the temple, or the hill, "will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it"? Do you take that literally? Does that mean there is going to be some great geological uplift, and the highest mountain in the world is going to be Mount Zion? Or is that a figure for saying that Jerusalem, a literal city, is going to be the most prominent city in the world? I'm inclined to think that this latter way to understand it is the real way to do it, but note, this is figurative. That's an element of a figure. There are those who say that the latter part of verse 2, quote, "be raised above the hills," end quote, is also to be taken literally, and that there will be a geologic elevation of Jerusalem at the end times. And J. Barton Payne, whom we've met before and will meet subsequently, takes that particular view. Now, if you say you're a literalist, is that statement indicative of the prominence of Jerusalem? Then you are back to this question of literal versus figurative. I think we all want to say we interpret literally when necessary. Yes, but what does that mean if you interpret literally? It doesn't mean there are no figures anywhere. You have to wrestle with things like that as well, even if you are a literalist. There are three options there, in terms of how to distinguish between literal and figurative. First option, you can go to an extremely figurative interpretation with respect to this verse and say it's not Jerusalem at all, it's the church. Second, you could go to a sort of modified figurative understanding and say it is Jerusalem, but it's talking about the prominence of Jerusalem, not that it will literally be raised above all the hills. Third, you can go to a completely literal interpretation and say it is Jerusalem, and we are talking about a great geographical and geological shift in elevation that is going to take place in the latter times. How do you tell what is figurative and literal? You see, it's not that easy. But you have to look at the scriptural uses of terms elsewhere and at the context of the passage you are dealing with. You see, where it goes, it says, many people will come and say, let's go to the mountain of the Lord. He will teach us his ways. Well, the rest of the passage talks about the prominence of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is at the center from which the Lord is going to rule. So it appears to me that we're talking about the prominence of Jerusalem, not necessarily a higher elevation. But that's something I don't think you can be absolutely certain about. As I said before, we all have to wrestle with these things. I've mentioned J. Barton Payne, and I would like you to look at page 6 of your citations, which are taken from J. Barton Payne's Encyclopedia of Prophecy. And he says, Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2a, and chapter 4, verse 1a, that is the first part of the first verse of chapter 4, we have the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established above the hills. He goes on to say that similar changes in topography are foretold in Zechariah chapter 14, second part of verse 4 and verse 10, end quote. Well, these are Zechariah's prophecies, and they are numbered 70 and 75 in J. Barton Payne's Encyclopedia. Well, he goes on and he says, so despite various allegorizing interpretations that have been proposed by both liberals and other conservatives for this exalting of Zion, that is to say, the elevation of Zion, he goes on to say the biblical teaching seems to be miraculous geological changes, fulfillment in the latter days, physical changes as the temple of Mount Moriah is elevated above its surroundings. This is what J. Barton Payne says. Now he says, and I quoted it before, elevated above its surroundings. It says it will be raised above the hills. The mountain of the Lord's temple will be chief among the mountains. Well, I guess you could ask, chief among what mountains? Presumably the highest mountains in that area. What about the surroundings? How far do we go? 5 miles? 10 miles? 50 or 100 miles? Thousands of miles? Do we include Mount Everest? I don't know. So even though J. Barton Payne says this is literal, there are still certain limits as to how literal you can take this. Well, another question that is often asked, usually as a critique of the pre-mill understanding of this passage in Isaiah 2:4, is the following. It says, nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Well, that last phrase, neither shall they learn war anymore, that's the King James Version. The NIV says, nor will they train for war anymore. Those who disagree with the pre-mill position say, how can you say that in a pre-mill context that there won't be war anymore? The key passage of the millennial position is in Revelation chapter 20, and it speaks that at the end of the millennium, Satan is going to be loosed and there is going to be war. So if you're saying that this passage refers to the millennial period, isn't that a contradiction with a prediction that there won't be war anymore? When, in Revelation, it says there will be war after the millennium? The King James says about Isaiah, neither shall they learn war anymore. And as I mentioned, the NIV says, nor will they train for war anymore. The New American Standard Bible is the strongest, and it says, and I'm quoting here, and never again will they learn war anymore, end quote. It's a bit redundant, but they're trying to emphasize that that's that. But all these translations suggest that this time of peace is going to be established and war will be over forever. The question is, how do you harmonize that with the premillennial position that talks about war after the millennium? An excellent question, and I would like to make this suggestion in response to that question. In Hebrew, we have this combination of the negative, lo, and the imperfect verb, od. In Hebrew, it's od lo. Look at its use in Exodus chapter 2, verse 3. And when she could no longer, I emphasize that, no longer od lo, hide him, etc., etc., That's in the context of Moses being hidden in the bulrushes just prior to that. So we read, when she could no longer hide him, she put him in the bulrushes. And it also says, when she could no longer hide him. And I'm stressing the no longer because that's this Hebrew od lo. It has the idea of a lack of continuation. Notice, she could no longer hide him. She was hiding him, but she couldn't continue that. It's not necessarily never again, that is, that she would never again hide him if she had the chance, but it's just a lack of continuation of what she was doing. Let's look at Joshua chapter 5, verse 1, when we read, neither was their spirit in them any more, od lo, for any more. Joshua 5, verse 1 is in the context of the conquest when Israel crossed the Jordan River and came into Canaan by that miraculous stopping of the Jordan waters. The inhabitants of Canaan were so fearful that they didn't have any spirit to go and attack the Israelites. That's why the Israelites could observe the Passover and circumcise all the males that hadn't been circumcised before. We read, neither was their spirit in them any more. And again, any more is od lo in Hebrew. That doesn't mean that never again would there be any spirit in the Canaanites to attack the Israelites, because they did so later. But it was a cessation, a lack of continuation of that spirit to attack that occurred at the time when Joshua and the Israelites crossed the Jordan. It is not the idea of never again. In Joshua chapter 5, verse 12, we read, neither had the children of Israel manna any more, and any more is od lo. Now, there you could perhaps debate it, because I think in the context, the point is that the manna did stop, and it stopped forever. At the point when they entered the land of Canaan, manna did cease permanently. They had been receiving manna every single day for years. Then it ceased. It did not continue. So it seems to me that the idea is not ad olam, forever, which would be another Hebrew phase of saying forever. But instead of ad olam, the phrase is od lo. That's not in that statement in Isaiah 2:4. That is, we read there od lo, not ad olam. It does not say there will not again, ever again be war, and in that sense, the New American Standard Bible is wrong in translating it, quote, never again will they learn for war, end quote. It's not that they will never again learn war, but a lack of continuance is suggested by this phrase, od lo, in the Hebrew. Now, there's a question on the clarification of Joshua chapter 5, verse 1, concerning the cessation of the manna. And Benoit says the following. The point of emphasis is that when they entered Canaan, the manna ceased. They would not continue to be sustained by the manna. But on the other hand, it may resume. The point is, it is not right now continuing. I think that is the point of the way in which Isaiah 2:4 is worded when it says, neither shall they learn war anymore. Neither shall they learn war, od lo, anymore. And that means it is not going to continue, not that it will never start up again. In other words, they're not going to continue to learn war anymore. There's going to be a lack of continuation of something that has existed over the entire course of human history. That's why it is so striking. Never has there been a time in human history when there haven't been wars going on. There is never going to be a time in human history when there are not going to be wars going on until Christ returns. But at that point, when he establishes his kingdom, there is going to be a change. That's not going to be a continuation of the sort of environment, war environment specifically, that has always characterized human existence. That doesn't mean that 1,000 years later it may not resume, but there will not be a continuation of something that has always been part of the human condition. So I don't think that that last phrase is an objection that rules out the validity of a premill interpretation of the passage, as some have tried to argue it does. Now, Young and Calvin say is fulfilled in principle now, and complete fulfillment is in the eternal state. The problem with that is the phrase, in the last days. How can you say the last days is the eternal state? The last days seems to put in this condition of the flow of human history that is continuing now, and that it is not the eternal state. The NIV has, quote, neither will they train for war anymore. The Hebrew word lamad literally means learn. There is coming a time when war is simply inappropriate. It will not be learned. The book of Revelation says that at the end of the millennium, there will be war again. At that point, there is going to be another war. The postmillennial position was largely held in the 1800s and died out with the world wars, mainly because the postmillennial position was based on what was going on at the time when there was peace and it looked like the gospel really could bring peace to the whole world. That idea came to a sudden end with World War I and should have been buried with World War II. Recently, however, the theonomy movement has had a revival of this idea. Well, that's enough for today. We'll pick up from there next time. That is lecture number 3 on the Major Prophets by Robert Vinoy of Biblical Theological Seminary. This was lecture number 3 on the prophet Isaiah.